At a hearing in the U.S. Senate this week, there was a rare showing of bipartisan agreement on an issue that tends to be one of the most divisive, gun control. Lawmakers were talking about something called red flag gun laws, a way of letting law enforcement or family members ask a court to take away a person's firearms if they're seen as a likely threat to themselves or others. In his opening remarks, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham acknowledged some of the concerns conservatives might have.
There are a lot of people may be worried, is the government going to come take your guns? And the answer is no. Nobody's going to come and take a gun from you. But there will be a process for law enforcement and family members to petition a court to say that somebody in your neighborhood or somebody down the street across town is about to blow.
Robert Spitzer is a distinguished service professor and department chair for political science at the State University of New York, Cortland. His books include Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, can you walk us through in a little more detail how these red flag gun laws work?
Sure. Version in the United States Senate that's being debated, and you just played the clip from Senator Graham, is similar to what we find in the states that have these laws. And by the way, there are 14 states plus the District of Columbia that have a red flag type law in place. The idea is that if there is an imminent threat, and there's an emphasis on a very sort of dire and immediate nature to a threat posed by a person, and this could be a threat to hurt themselves or a threat to hurt others, a kind of a crisis moment, that a person, a family member, for example, or the police directly can go before a judge and ask for a temporary order to have guns withdrawn from that home, from that person, on a temporary basis, subject to a court hearing that's held shortly thereafter to determine what's going on. Does this person, in fact, pose such a threat or not? And if so, the guns can be kept away permanently. If not, the guns can be returned to the person. And this sounds like something that, you know, might be happening prolifically. But in the 14 states that have had these laws in place, and a number of these states have enacted these laws fairly recently, there's only been a little over 1,000 cases that have occurred up until now. So it's a pretty small number. But it does provide a safety valve moment for somebody who clearly is having emotional problems, is having, you know, anger issues that are evident to the people around them, and it's a way that guns can be pulled out of that situation, at least temporarily.
How are states defining that threshold? Because it seems like there could be a lot of gray area in trying to determine what might pose an imminent threat.
That's true, and you'd really have to burrow into the particular laws of the particular states. I'm sure there are variations in wording, but the general emphasis in these laws is on an immediate, imminent threat. You know, somebody saying, I'm going to kill myself, for example. And by the way, the biggest threat tends to be, when connected to guns, tends to be suicide, not homicide. There certainly are gun homicides and threats made with guns every year, but nationwide, pretty consistently, there are about twice as many gun suicides as there are gun homicides. And that is very much a concern because of the fact that a gun is a very effective way for a person to kill oneself, more effective than any other method.
I know these are all, I think, fairly new. Do we have any kind of indication as to whether red flag gun laws are having an impact when it comes to suicide numbers or homicide numbers in these states?
Well, given the relatively small numbers, there aren't what you would call decisive statistics. However, it is the case that in at least two states, in Indiana and in Connecticut, both states have had these laws on the books for a while. Indiana saw an almost 8% reduction in the firearm suicide rate after it enacted one of these laws, and Connecticut saw a 14% reduction in the firearm suicide rate after it enacted its similar red flag law. So there is good evidence to see, in particular with respect to suicide, that this can have an effect. And we also know that there's a sort of a different but related body of research regarding the intersection of domestic violence, threats within the context of an intimate relationship, a husband, a wife, an intimate partner where threats and violence can escalate, and where when guns are present in such a situation, the likelihood that a fatality will result escalates significantly. So there's pretty good reason to believe that this is a place and a time and a moment where you really want the government to have some ability with procedural safeguards to intervene.
Talking to Robert Spitzer, political science professor at the State University of New York, Cortland, about red flag gun laws. Let's take this to Congress now. Robert, as I understand it, what they're talking about there in the Senate is not creating a federal red flag gun law, but rather creating ways for states to help states do their own laws.
I don't have a lot of the details on the federal effort, but the very fact that the Republican-controlled Senate and Senator Graham, who's pretty conservative and considered pretty strongly gun rights, is saying this is a worthy idea. We should investigate this and you know, encourage movement along these lines, I think is fairly significant. And it's also important to note that a number of the states that have enacted these laws are states where they were signed into law by Republican governors. So it is one measure that has found genuine bipartisan support.
How does the NRA, the National Rifle Association, fit into the politics surrounding red flag gun laws?
Well, they're trying to walk a fine line on this issue. They say they support the idea in principle, but they're not too happy with the existing measures that are floating around. These are measures that are popular, that law enforcement wants to have as a tool, obviously that threatened relatives would be able to utilize. So they're not flat out against it, but they're kind of casting aspersions on existing laws and the measure at the federal level, as if to say that, well, if they could get the law right, maybe the NRA would be okay with it, but they're not sure that that's happened yet.
One concern I've seen is due process rights, violations of due process rights for someone who's had their gun taken away. They don't have, before the gun is initially taken away, the ability to challenge this in the courts. Usually they can do that retroactively after the fact. Is this a common objection to these kind of laws?
It is. It certainly is. I mean, any notion of taking away somebody's guns for any reason always raises some suspicion, even under circumstances and some awareness on the part of the gun community. But it is clear that there are some circumstances where that is warranted. And it's typically the case that a judge can issue what's called an emergency order to pull guns from a residence, from, let's say, a person who's made specific threats. And they then schedule a hearing. The hearing has to be held in a fairly short space of time. And that is part of the idea of having some procedural safeguards. And you're, you know, presenting information before a magistrate. It's not only on, well, a person says that somebody else poses a threat and so the police sweep in and that's it. They do. There is some evaluation of the claims, consideration of some kind of evidence. And then you do have the formal hearing later on to determine whether, in fact, the gun should be returned to the person or not.
We're talking to Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York, Cortland. He's with us to talk about red flag gun laws that allows law enforcement and sometimes others to ask a court for permission to remove guns from a person's possession if it's agreed they pose a threat to themselves or others, an imminent threat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of red flag gun laws? Do you think they strike a good balance between public safety and the Second Amendment? Would you want to see some version of this law here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about red flag gun laws and how they fit into the wider gun debate. Robert Spitzer is with us from the State University of New York, Cortland. He's written multiple books on gun politics in the United States, among others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea, allowing police or in some cases family members to petition a court to request that firearms be removed from the possession of a person seen as an imminent threat to others or to themselves? If you're a gun owner, what do you think of this idea? And in general, would you want to see this happen here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Bob is with us in New Berlin. Bob, hello.
Hi. I support gun rights, but with that being said, I was once, not so long ago, sitting on the edge of a bed in a mental ward with a man I was visiting who was very, very angry that his guns had been taken from him. And he was saying, you know, it makes you wonder how much you can take before you just grab your gun and take out as many people as you can before they take you out. And I think, you know, that was scary. And what's worse is, of course, he did get his guns back. He's, you know, he wasn't convicted of violence or anything, but he was mentally ill and certainly expressing to me that he had the idea that, you know, this would be a good thing. And what I told him, I said, well, because you're a Christian, you can't do that. Otherwise, you have to find a different religion or something, because that's not the way of the Bible. And he looked down and he said, yeah, I guess you're right.
Bob, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. Robert, can you talk about how people in that kind of situation in a state with a red flag gun law would then proceed?
Well, yes. And let me thank Bob for calling in and sharing his story, because that's a real life moment of how this kind of thing to play. And note also that this action, these red flag laws, are triggered by some very specific language that is designed to set a pretty high bar at the point at which the local police might intervene. And it also, it's not to say that anybody who has mental illness is going to have their guns taken away. After all, most people who have mental illness issues are not a threat of violent, don't pose a violent threat to themselves or others. Some people do if, for example, you're suicidal or if you're in a homicidal rage and it might be related to your mental condition, then that stuff does come into play. So it's the attitude plus the expression of, you know, I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to kill these people that then could trigger a red flag law action.
Thanks again for calling and sharing that experience. We'll go now to Karen with us in Cambridge. Karen, hello.
Hi. I have a question about what happens now. If my loved one is sitting in the bathroom with a gun threatening to kill himself and I call 911, can they not come and confiscate that weapon now?
Karen, thanks for the law. Robert, I don't know if you know specifically in Wisconsin, but in general, without a red flag gun law, what generally happens?
That's a good question, and it depends on how the existing law in Wisconsin is written. There have been efforts in some places in the past to make it pretty difficult for police to intercede and to pull out weapons from a situation of that nature. So it's hard for me to say, you know, how the existing law reads. But of course, part of the purpose of the red flag law is to try to intercede before the point at which a person's holding a gun, pointing it at his or her head, or pointing it at the, you know, at the body of another human being in close proximity and, you know, clearly indicating violence. You'd like to get to that, intercede before that final step occurs.
In our last couple of minutes, Robert, do you see these red flag gun laws likely to spread now to more and more states?
It does seem likely that more and more states will pick up on these, partly because they found bipartisan support in a number of states. And I would also add also that there is a precedent for these laws, even though these red flag laws themselves are relatively new. If you go back to the 19th, 18th, and even 17th century in America, you saw many laws enacted by states and communities against brandishing. That is the threatening display of a weapon. And that all by itself, under old American laws in the states and even in some of the colonies, was a punishable effect. And this is sort of a modern version of that, where they're trying to get to the point just before a person may actually have a gun, brandish it, and threaten others. So the idea of threatening people with a gun is one that actually has roots in our law, and I think you'll see these modern laws spreading to other states.
And again, briefly, as we wrap up, is this a law, despite all the divisiveness over gun control issues, is this a law that you can see people from both parties working together on?
I think that has already been demonstrated. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, conservative Republican, is indicating support. The very fact that they held hearings, which the majority party does not have to do, is an indication that they believe in the United States Senate that this is a measure worthy of careful and serious examination. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it's one area where opposing sides on the gun issue and of the political parties can reach across the aisle and do some constructive bipartisan work.
We'll leave it there. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Good to speak with you.
That was Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor and Department Chair for Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland. His books include Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. He joined us today to talk about red flag gun laws after some Republicans in the U.S. Senate said this week they're open to helping states to pass those kind of gun regulations. On Tuesday, voters will pick Wisconsin's next Supreme Court justice. Appeals Court judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer are both running to replace retiring Justice Shirley Abrahamson. In our second of two stories on the candidates, Sean Johnson has this profile of Neubauer, who has downplayed her ties to the Democratic Party and emphasized her time on the bench.
Almost every candidate tries to stay on message when they run for statewide office. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer is no exception. At a recent debate with Appeals Court Judge Brian Hagedorn at the Wisconsin State Bar Center in Madison, it wasn't hard to guess which points Neubauer wanted people to remember.
My record shows that I am tough but fair. My record shows that I am fair, impartial, and independent. Justice, be fair, impartial, independent. That I will be fair, impartial, and independent.
And that was just during her opening statement. Neubauer repeated some variation of tough, independent, and fair at least a dozen times during that debate, and she drove home other points, too. For more than a decade, she said, she's been a judge, and she has endorsements from the vast majority of judges throughout Wisconsin.
Over 98% of the judges endorsing this race are supporting me, and they are willing to support me publicly. I have put them on my website.
In this officially nonpartisan election, Neubauer's ties to the Democratic Party run deep. Her daughter, Greta Neubauer, is a Democratic state representative. Her husband, Jeff Neubauer, is a former lawmaker who once ran the state Democratic Party. But compared to recent Supreme Court campaigns, what Neubauer is saying is less partisan. She steers clear of many of the buzzwords candidates often use to hint at their political leanings. She won't even say who she considers her most influential Supreme Court justices.
To the extent people want to understand sort of where I come from, what my philosophy is, I ask that they judge me based on my record.
Neubauer is taking this approach while others are firing up the Democratic base for her. Among those campaigning here is a group led by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee.
Bound and determined, I'm back in Wisconsin, you know. How are you all doing? All right.
During a recent visit to Madison, Holder said he did not worry that his support for Neubauer would undercut her nonpartisan message.
You know, it's not as if Republicans aren't doing the same thing. You know, it's not as if, you know, business groups aren't pouring tons of money into these races. You know, and I'm just dealing with the reality of the situation. And so I'm proud to be here and I'm proud to support, you know, Lisa.
Neubauer says she'll recuse herself from any cases involving Holder. But her opponent, Judge Brian Hagedorn, says there's a reason groups like Holder's are supporting Neubauer.
They want to take over the Supreme Court because they want to politicize it. They want the court to be part of their political agenda. And they think Judge Neubauer is exactly the person for the job.
Neubauer's backers argue it's not Holder's support that's key in this race. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Stark, who has endorsed Neubauer, says it's more telling that 345 judges have supported Neubauer over Hagedorn, even though they both serve on the same Court of Appeals.
That says a lot. These are the people who either their decisions are reviewed by her on a regular basis, or they work with her directly. And they also work with Judge Hagedorn, and they know the two of them, and they have supported Judge Neubauer. So I think that speaks volumes.
Conservatives currently hold a 4-3 majority on the Supreme Court. A Hagedorn victory would expand that margin. A Neubauer win would preserve it and set the stage for a 2020 campaign that could flip the court's ideological balance. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's profile of Judge Brian Hagedorn aired yesterday. You can read or listen to both of those stories at WPR.org or WisconsinVote.org. And while you're at WisconsinVote.org, you can do more election-related stuff. Election Day is April 2nd. At WisconsinVote.org, you can find your polling place, view your sample ballot, read candidate profiles, and more. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the census is a-coming next year, and it could have a big impact on states and how we're represented in Congress. We'll find out why Wisconsin could lose a congressional seat when the counting is done. You can find out the latest news from Wisconsin Public Radio and ask your questions on this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. And we might think of roller skating as a quaint, old-time tradition, and we'd be wrong. We'll find out why roller rinks are back in style, and maybe I'll try on some skates. Spoiler alert, I won't. That and more, it's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.